Again, good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you may be, and welcome to EM Forum. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. Now, for any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to be part of this discussion. Now, if you need assistance, you can select Lori Weaver from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and she will try to assist you via private chat. Today's program is about a new report from the National Academies on disaster resilience that makes specific recommendations for a national approach to enhancing disaster recovery in the future. Please note that you can access a free PDF version of the report as well as a summary from the links on today's background slide. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Today's recording and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Dr. Cutter is one of our foremost hazards researchers, and we are delighted she was willing to join us today. She served as chair of the authoring committee for this report, is a Carolina Distinguished Professor of Geography, and director of the Hazards and Vulnerability Research Institute at the University of South Carolina. Please do see today's background page for further biographical details and links to related resources. Please note that the Institute's website in particular provides access to a wealth of hazard data. Welcome, Susan, and thank you again for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy. And welcome, everyone. It's a great treat to be able to talk to you about this important report that was recently released by the National Academies called Disaster Resilience. But as many of you know, reports don't come about by one individual's effort. And I want to publicly acknowledge the committee who drafted this report and who did yeoman service in making this something that we can be proud of, but also that the nation can be proud of. So what is the problem and why now on this report? Well, it's clear that no one is immune from disasters. Disasters happen everywhere. They happen to all kinds of people in all kinds of places. We also know that losses are escalating. In 2012, we had $11 billion disasters, which was actually less than the year before. But in total, we see that the losses are increasing. We know that all of this is happening at a time when communities face very difficult choices about the best ways to maintain community functions under fiscal constraints and social policies. We also know that there has been a collective body of knowledge over the past 60 years or so about how to reduce losses. And we know that losses can be reduced by taking a more proactive approach, one that builds resilience ahead of time rather than waiting until after the disaster occurs. Such an approach that we're calling resilience builds on this wealth of knowledge from both the technical knowledge, scientific knowledge, but practical knowledge that the community has amassed over this time period about the causes of hazards and disasters and the ways in which we can protect ourselves from them through preparedness activities, planning activities, mitigation, and then more effective response and recovery. So the committee was faced with this seeming dilemma of how do we think about enhancing the nation's resilience, and do we proceed with the status quo, which is doing things we've already done, or do we take this opportunity through this report to lay out a strategy and findings about the nation becoming more resilient? And clearly, the committee offered and opted for the becoming more resilient. And the choice we have really was not a choice in our mind. We know that disasters are going to continue to occur, and that some of these extremes will get even more routine under changing climate conditions. We know that people are moving into more hazardous environments, particularly along the coast. We also know that there's increasing exposure to drought. We are increasing in age, and our population is growing. Our public infrastructure is well beyond its design limits. And I think we finally, as a nation and communities within the nation, have come to the recognition that we can't really completely eliminate risk, but there is some residual risk that always needs to be managed in some way. Now, one of the first tasks that the committee had was to develop their definition of resilience, because resilience means different things to different people. And so we scoured through the literature, we looked at federal government reports, and we decided as a group to take a very broad view of resilience. And we defined resilience, again, very, very broadly, as the ability to prepare and plan for, absorb, recover from, or more successfully adapt to actual or potential adverse events. And by taking this broad definition of resilience, we are able to include a variety of different types of resilience and perspectives within this. And so far, this has proven to be a very good strategy because the umbrella is quite large. Another thing that the committee thought about was to speculate on what the characteristics of a resilient nation might look like in the year 20. And we did this for two reasons. One, it helped clarify our thinking in terms of where we would like to be as a nation. But also it set out a goal for figuring out how we might get there. So from our perspective, a resilient nation in 20 years or so is one where the individuals and communities are their first line of defense against disasters, that they take proactive action to reduce their risk. We see a nation where there is national leadership in resilience throughout the agencies and, more importantly, in Congress, where community-level resilience efforts receive federal, state, and regional investments and support. We see a characteristic of specific risk information that is readily available, that is transparent, that is effectively communicated so everyone understands it. We see a nation where zoning ordinances are enacted and enforced, and where building codes and retrofit standards are widely adopted and enforced. We see a resilient nation as one where a significant percentage of the post-disaster recovery is funded through private capital and insurance payouts, not the federal government per se. We see where insurance premiums are risk-based, where community coalitions have contingency plans that provide those services, particularly to those most vulnerable populations after disasters. And we see where post-disaster recovery is accelerated because of infrastructure redundancy and upgrades in the existing infrastructure. Now, to begin the task, the study was overseen by the Disasters Roundtable and the Committee on Science, Engineering, and Public Policy. And this means that the study involved all three academies, the Academy of Sciences, the Academy of Engineering, and the Institutes of Medicine. And in many ways, this was a watershed event for the academies because of the number of federal sponsors for the study, which was 9. And we were asked to do a number of things. One, define national resilience, and I gave you that definition, and to frame the issues that might be involved in increasing the resilience, to provide some information on goals and baseline conditions and performance metrics for resilience, to describe the state of knowledge that we have about resilience to hazards and disasters in the nation, to outline gaps and obstacles, and then to prevent the conclusions and recommendations. A couple of things as we go through the specific findings and recommendations, and these are all tied to the relevant chapters. The first background is that we view communities as systems of systems. That is, communities had environment components to them, infrastructure, social, institutional, economic, and we also felt that all of these elements must be robust within a community, and they must be collaborative. We examined the whole question of managing risks, and one of the findings was that reducing risk really does require a disciplined approach, one where you identify the risk, you develop a strategy to deal with it, but you keep that strategy flexible and current so that you can engage with behavioral responses of uncertainty where you know you're going to have multiple partners and stakeholders and where there's a variety of tools that are available, some of which are related to structural approaches, constructions, for example, and non-structural approaches. And so the idea here is that in managing risks, a one-size-fits-all strategy is not going to be the most effective because places are different, the hazards that affect them are different, and the communities themselves are different as well. We also felt that we needed to make a business case for the resilience investment. Why should the nation care? Why does it make sense to invest in resilience? And we found here that there is no consistent database in the United States for understanding the patterns of hazard events and losses. We know that, we hypothesize that building the business case for resilience demonstrates that these will have short and long-term benefits, but in order to prove it, we need such databases. And while we don't have them now, we have portions of them in different agencies and institutions, but they need to be improved in terms of their measurement and their accuracy and their consistency. For example, not all losses are counted, and there's some aspects of community assets, like the social or environmental value of assets in communities that are not included in any of these databases. At the same time, we know that we need some way of measuring progress as we develop strategies to enhance resilience. And so we need a consistent basis for measuring resilience that includes the multiple dimensions that are embodied within it. We know that there are some existing national and international indicators that measure different aspects of community systems and hazards, but we don't have a consistent framework for measuring resilience. The committee did not come up with a metric per se, but thought about what might be included within a measurement system. And what we felt was that there needed to be something on the critical infrastructure and its ability to perform, that we needed information on social factors, and the social factors tend to limit the ability of a community to recover. We needed something on communities and structures and their capacity to withstand the different types of disasters. And then we needed something that captured the special needs of individuals and groups. And this discussion is actually found in Chapter 4, which looks at measuring progress. One of the things that the committee recognized very early on was enhancing resilience is not simply a top-down effort, that it requires bottom-up integration as well. And resilience begins with strong local capacity, and it begins with engagement of communities and residents in policy and practice, and their ability to communicate risk, to organize, to prepare for risk, and the will to adopt risk reduction measures. And so we've come up with a chapter on how you build the local capacity, which is embodied in Chapter 5 in the report. Having started with a bottom-up, and there are different kinds of strategies that, that one can facilitate, there also needs to be efforts at the national level. And we know that strong governance at all levels is a key element in building resilience. We also know that policies need to take the long-term view and to help diminish the impact of these short-term expediencies that come up in how decisions are made. We also recognize that some of the government policies and practices actually have some unintended consequences that can negatively influence resilience. We found that there are gaps in policies and programs in the federal agencies, and that there are some gaps that also result from the legislative authority under which these agencies operate. The end result is that the nation does not have an overall vision or coordinating strategy for resilience. Although the implementation of Presidential Directive 8 will address some of these consistency and coordinating issues, we still are lacking in such a broad-based strategy. The big problem and the big kind of conclusion that the report came out is after looking at all these findings, if we are going to establish resilience as a key principle within the federal agencies and in our local communities, we need to have a culture of resilience. And we need to understand and build this culture of resilience. And in this way, we will be able to develop the necessary infrastructure, both human infrastructure and physical infrastructure, to move forward and achieve that vision of a resilient nation in 2030. So what are the specific recommendations that came out of the report? Well, the first is that the federal government agencies should incorporate national resilience as an organizing principle within their agencies, and to use this organizing principle as a way to guide the mission and the actions of that agency. Number two, the public and private sectors need to work cooperatively to encourage commitments and investments in risk management strategies that are complementary. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy, but one that must be tailored to the needs of the local communities with the tools that are readily available. Number three, we do need this national resource of disaster-related data that can help document the injuries, loss of life, property loss, and economic losses. And this database can be used to support better risk modeling, but also is one that can be used to understand the geographic differences in the impact of disasters and the differences based on social vulnerability. We think it's important to develop a baseline of resilience metrics that allows us to move forward and assess our progress as we move toward that goal of 2030. And we think that this development of a resilience scorecard or something like this should be done with federal agencies taking the lead, but also with the engagement and involvement of state and local partners and professional groups. Recommendation number five is that we should have the development and support of resilience coalitions at local levels and regional levels. And that recommendation six is that the federal agencies should ensure that they're promoting their national resilience in their programs and policies by looking at a self-assessment to make sure that they're not working at cross purposes with the goals of building and enhancing a resilient nation. Unlike other studies at the National Academies, this particular study has another year or approximately 8 months left on its contract. And this was done intentionally so that we could engage in a national conversation and to do outreach efforts to involve the community of practice and local communities as we move forward as a nation. We had a public event in November that was a symposium and webcast, which is available on the Academy website. And last week, we were involved in a program sponsored by the USCPA and in a program by the National Council for Science and the Environment. The committee has also engaged in briefings on the Hill and briefings at the White House. We have also started to set up briefings across the country, and we've done agency briefings as well. So we think that this is a bold vision. It is one that we need to work on collectively. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I think turn it back to Amy.
Thank you very much, Susan. Appreciate your efforts there. Okay, we will move to our Q&A because we do want to get some feedback from the folks that are with us today. So to ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel and then type in the area underneath. Now, I'm going to close the chat panel at this point to make it a little bit easier to figure out which panel to put that in. Give me one moment. All right. And then please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. We are ready to begin now. I know it may take a moment or two for you all to, gather your thoughts, but when you're ready, please do enter your comment or question at any time. And I do want to recommend the summary as a good way to get started on this. It's, you know, by the time you take out the front matter and the end matter, it's only about 14 or 15 pages, but it gets, I think you did a very good job with that, Susan, or the committee. Okay, well, still waiting for any questions or comments we may have. Okay, here, I've got one now from Taylor Conafy, who asks, how do you foresee public and private agencies working together in disaster response?
Well, I think they already are working together in disaster response, where you see them forging partnerships in terms of pre-positioning of assets outside of the impacted area and coordinating those assets with the federal government. I know this was done for Superstorm Sandy, and I think we have a new era where these private and public partnerships are increasingly important in enhancing the community.
And let's expand that a little bit more broadly and not just disaster response. You did mention in getting the private sector engaged, and what do you see that they have to bring to the table in terms of enhancing resilience pre-disaster?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to think about is in the area of infrastructure. Most of the nation's infrastructure is private.
Sure.
And so we need to get the private sector involved in building resilience, but because it's the private sector, it becomes a business investment in the business case. And so you need perhaps some way of working with local communities in terms of perhaps tax breaks or something like that, that would then encourage the private sector to develop a more resilient infrastructure that would serve that community in both the short term and the long term.
Very good. Okay, I have a couple more questions here. One from Miguel Escalins. I'm sorry when I butcher people's last names. He asked, do you believe the president's new agenda for climate change will enhance community resiliency, and if so, how?
Absolutely. I think last year there was a report that came out from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that special report was looking at climate change and disasters. And one of the conclusions of that report is that if you mitigate for disasters in the short run, you actually build climate change adaptation in the long run. So I think these two issues are linked. And I think if you take, again, the longer view, which is very difficult for Americans to think that, anything that we look at, we always want to be satisfied now. But I think building resilience is a long-term strategy, and anything looking at climate change is also going to be looking at longer-term strategies to reduce the impact.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you were involved in that report as well, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Yep. So we know they had some good input on that. Okay, Merritt asks, and I think you sort of addressed this on your last slide, but perhaps you might expand on it a little bit. Merritt asks, will there be additional meetings, symposiums in the future?
The answer is yes. We're trying to figure out now what those will be like. I know the committee visited three communities. We actually got out of Washington, D.C. to do our work, and we went to the Mississippi Gulf Coast and New Orleans. We went to Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, Iowa, and we went to Southern California. And I know that we are going to be talking about the report to the folks in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in May of 2008 on the anniversary of the big flood that they had there in 2008. We're also, I believe, trying to develop some web outreach where we may have a question of the month that people can talk about and chat about, again, to try and stimulate a conversation about resilience.
I'm going to throw in a question, although we've got a few. I think we're going to have plenty to take us through the hour today. You mentioned that you were doing staff briefings and so on. What kind of reception are you getting from folks in the Congress?
We're getting good support in Congress. We haven't briefed a lot of the senators and congresspeople. We've been briefing agencies as well, and it's resonating quite well within the agencies themselves, including agencies that were not sponsors of the report. I think at the time that the report came out, Congress was a little busy doing other things.
Right.
And so it wasn't as high on their agenda as we would like it to be. But nevertheless, I think now that we have a new Congress, we'll make another effort to go back over to the Hill and sit down and chat with those folks.
That'd be great. And I think they've actually incorporated at least some Stafford Act type provisions in some new legislation, so perhaps we'll see how that shakes out as well.
Right.
Okay. Rich Van Dam asks, has the DHS Private Sector Preparedness Program been part of your review? We were talking about the private sector earlier, so I assume that's where it's coming from.
We looked at all kinds of evidences. We didn't really single out, you know, one particular program over another, but that was part of the evidence and materials that we looked at.
Okay. Carl Ribstock says, what funding or incentives are available to communities considering undertaking baseline assessments of infrastructure, environment, social capacity, et cetera? I think the point of the report is we need more of that, right?
Right. There's all the programs at DHS.
There's some, I think, in the pre-disaster mitigation program.
Right.
I'm not sure what the status
Exactly. But the idea is that they're not transparent enough. And do you do it under your hazard mitigation planning, or do you do it under some other program? And so one of the things that the committee would like to see is the federal government kind of reorient some of these pre-impact programs so that they actually focus on resilience in the pre-impact state.
Yeah, and that's part of the agency coordination, I would think.
Right.
You have some, like in the flood program, I'm thinking of the community rating
system
in terms of incentives. You probably got something under the Earthquake Hazard Reduction Program and so forth. So it would be nice if you had those all coordinated somehow.
Right.
But, again, that takes legislation. Okay, I got one from Ava Jean. She says, do you know of specific communities attempting to build resilience that could be monitored, reported on, and highlighted as examples for other communities to follow? Good one. Evidently, you have some experience up there in Iowa.
We have some experience in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
We have some limited experience across the country. We didn't see many exemplars like you had in the formal program, let's say, of Project Impact years and years ago. But we think there are good examples out there. We just haven't discovered them yet.
Right.
And we think people are actually working toward disaster resilience, but they may not be calling it that. And so this is one of the reasons why we've got some outreach as part of our program, so that we can continue to push this and look at the communities across the nation as much as we can identify them to see what is being done.
You know, and that might be a good idea for that that website that we put out the link to, that last one, where the National Conversation on Resilience. Seems to me, I did take a look at the site, and there's a place where you can post information like that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, good deal. I'm going to jump in with a couple. I don't want to get too deep into it, but it seems to me that the you mentioned the in this the symposium you had in D.C. There was some, you know, that was set in the context of post Sandy versus your report, which was pre Sandy, I believe, at least in the writing of it. I myself am seeing in the news that there's some, at least some growing awareness about how extremely vulnerable some areas are. Can you speak to a little bit about how the experience in Sandy is relating to this?
I think one of the important aspects of Sandy was that it showed in the major media market in the country in very graphic ways the need for disaster resilience. And I think what you see in Sandy in the New York area, and perhaps lesser so in the New Jersey area, is a more thoughtful conversation about recovery. And while there is a rush to try and recover quickly, a lot of people are slowing the process down a little bit to ask the questions, how can we make our recovery more resilient? And this, to me, is the first time that I've seen these conversations happening among government entities. And if you look to the New York 2100 plan that Governor Cuomo put out, it's all about resilience. And it's all about how do we build a resilient community back. And what are those sorts of choices that we need to make as communities? So I think that conversation is starting, and I think it's a good conversation for us to have, because these losses are not sustainable. We have to do something.
You know, I think some of the planning efforts up there in New York had to do with, you know, these coastal impacts from climate change, with some funding from EPA. Was EPA one of the sponsoring agencies on the report?
No, it was not.
I'm surprised. Okay. All right, let's move on. Deborah Matterly, she says, how do you encourage, require state and local governments as well as the private sector to include mitigation and resilience in their new and renewal projects? For example, highways, transit, utilities, et cetera, especially as budgets are tight.
This is why one of the aspects of the report is making the business case, right? If you make the business case that it makes economic sense to do this, then I think people will buy into it. If you say you need to do this, you know, because it makes us feel good, under these economic realities, that's not going to work. So what the committee is thinking is that you need to shift the approach. We need to make the business case for resilience, why it pays, why it pays sense to do it, why it makes sense to do it, and why it's ethical to do it. And so a lot of our efforts were focused in on how do you demonstrate that resilience works, that resilience will save lives, that resilience will save dollars, and that the private sector will become engaged in it because it makes economic sense for them to do so.
Great. Tara Laycox asks, can you comment on methodologies for risk assessments or hazard risk vulnerability assessments and how to integrate or bring together different results from approaches that may be used locally, given that the goal is national consistency? Good point.
Well, we could have a whole
right.
webinar on that, but there are ways to aggregate data that are important at the local level into state and federal databases. Those data can be linked geographically through the use of geographic information systems, for example. And that's one of the best ways of gathering that empirical basis in support of risk assessment. If you do risk assessments locally where you have that fine-grained detail, they can then be aggregated up to a county level, to a state level, and to the national level without much difficulty.
Yes, in fact, we've done a program in the past with you on the Social Vulnerability Index.
Index,
which
right.
Incorporates that type of data. And then you do have some other hazard data at your institute that can be downloaded as well. So I would suggest you, and we have a link to the institute site on our background page, so you might check that out as well, Kara. But I see where she's coming from in terms of, having some kind of national approach to doing this so that you can have some equal measures across, the country versus, just trying to compare apples and oranges.
Right, and I think that was the idea behind this national scorecard kind of approach.
Sure.
Where there would be some baseline indicators that would be used everywhere, but then they could be customized for the local experience. We're thinking of things like the LEED certification, for example, where you have to have certain things in your buildings in order to become LEED certified platinum, for example. And so the development of those sort of minimal things that would monitor resilience, we think would work across the nation, but then communities would customize that a little bit more so that they could monitor their own progress independent of what was going on nationally.
Okay, so the concept with the scorecard was to kind of develop a national model and then folks can adapt?
Correct.
Okay.
But there would be some basis of comparison across all communities because
exactly.
they would be measuring, let's say, for the sake of argument, 5 different parameters. But for some communities, they would have 20 parameters, and the other communities would have 6. But those 5 would constitute the national comparison, and you could compare community A to community B because they all collected or the scorecard was based on the same information.
I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the loss data that, one of the parts of the report pointed out how we don't have a nice single consistent repository of loss data, just fragments, depending on program or so on. What does the insurance industry do for, I assume they, collect this kind of loss data to base their actuarial rates and so forth, but I presume they're not necessarily willing to share that, or do they have a role?
Well, the insurance industry collects data on insured properties.
True. Mm-hmm.
Not uninsured properties. They may collect some data on business interruption, but it's only for those policies that they hold and the market share that they have. NOAA, through the National Climate Data Center, collects weather-related events.
Gotcha.
And we get some loss statistics from them, but they don't do anything on geophysical events. There you have to go to the USGS. But the USGS is great in collecting data on the physical dimensions of the events, but not as good on the social in terms of, you know, dollars lost or injuries. The Centers for Disease Control have data on fatalities from natural hazards, and those data don't always articulate with what you find from NCDC or from USGS. And everybody has a piece of the flood action.
Right.
And so you can look at these databases with each other, and some are aggregated at levels that aren't useful for county emergency managers. So the only place where there's been an attempt to bring them together is through a database that we have called SHELDUS, SHELDUS.org. And this is a database at the county level for the whole United States. It has 18 different hazard types, natural hazard types, and it's searchable online and it's downloadable online. And it compiles all of these federally based databases into one and reconciles it at the county level, because that's where emergency management begins.
And it's free.
And it's free.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that. Very good. Okay, let's take a few more from our audience. Miguel again asks, are your efforts linked in any way with FEMA's Strategic Foresight Initiative? Are you familiar with that program, Susan?
I'm peripherally knowledgeable of that program, and the answer is no.
Okay, we have a loyal ham operator that always joins us, and I wanted to address this question, but I think you can broaden it out a little bit more to talk about various community groups. And he says, most amateur radio ham club volunteers to help with public events such as parades, marathons, et cetera, as well as providing communications assistance for local served agencies and emergency responders. Is there any mention in the report about this focus? And I guess if you not necessarily take the ham clubs as a community-based organization, you definitely talk about the community-based organization.
Right. We talk a lot about community-based organizations. We also talk a lot about crowdsourcing information. And the use of the new technologies, such as Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, in providing real-time crowdsourced information. And, again, that is included in Chapter 4. So I would suggest if people are interested in how you use that kind of local knowledge by – residents or community-based organizations, that's where we bring it in.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have a specific question from Taylor on that point. I think you've answered it, but Taylor asks, do you believe crowdsourced information is effective, particularly in disaster relief, where information is abundantly available from non-governmental agencies?
Well, I think we have pretty good experience that it is effective. We have the Haiti experience. We have wildfires in Southern California. And there is a process with the crowdsourced information that it's actually pretty self-correcting. And I think in the past, federal agencies, governmental agencies were a little concerned about the crowdsourcing information. But now I think there's much more of a relaxed attitude about it, that it does have some effect and can be very useful in the immediate response period.
Yeah, and Taylor, so if you're interested in this particular aspect, apparently it is covered in the report as well.
Mm-hmm.
So. All right, another question from Ava Jean, who asks, what role does, quote, political will play at all levels of government in building a resilient nation, state, or community?
Well, Abhijit has a way of asking the central question. And if we don't have the political will to do it, it won't get done. And getting that political will means taking a long-term view over a short term. It means making tough decisions. It means making the business case and the political case for engagement with communities and articulation from the local to the national level. We think that that political will is there, but we need a spokesperson, and we think that it should come from the national level with setting the vision for what we want a resilient nation to look like.
And that, to me, that's one of the things that struck me most about your report, and I think is something new. This idea of setting a goal, or at least having a conversation about what the goal should be, whether it's 2030 or, you know, something else. And it seems to me if you could at least get folks talking about what the goal should be, you know, some kind of consensus on that, that might help spur some will to achieve it.
Right. And the idea was we didn't want a report that just said, here, you know, develop a vision. So we wanted to provide actionable recommendations to the nation that they could take, some which is pretty low-hanging fruit, like enforce your building code,
right.
And others which, you know, may take a while to get our heads wrapped around this new kind of ethic and culture of resilience. But it just makes so much sense, just like mitigation makes so much sense. But you could see that we've not done as good a job as we could have with hazard mitigation. So setting up this as a building a culture, having leadership at all levels, making the business case and getting everyone involved because it's everybody's business, and then moving forward toward that vision for 2030, we think is the step in the right direction.
Kind of following on that, we have John Contestabile, who has a couple of questions here. He says, resilience is the new thing, quote unquote, but how do you see this approach being accepted, adopted across these various agencies, DHS, FEMA, NOAA, Corps of Engineers, et cetera, the dozens of disparate programs in the federal space? Isn't this a real roadblock to widespread adoption, and how can we operationalize?
Well, we saw in our examination of some of the things that were going on in the federal space that there's quite a bit of activity on resilience, but it's uncoordinated, it's overlapping, and there are gaps. And so one of the ideas is let's charge the federal government or ask them to do a self-assessment of their programs and policies to see that they're promoting resilience. And then if every federal agency does it, then we can look across the federal agencies to identify overlap, to identify gaps, and to do a better job at coordinating it. We need an Office of Resilience, and that would help this coordinated function. I think we have a lot of that are going on in the federal space, but they're going on in these different silos that are not, and people are not talking to each other. The programs are not coordinated at all, and we need to do that.
Have you all done any outreach to like NEMA and IAM and, you know, other professional associations, perhaps in the planning area and so on?
We are in that process now. Setting up some briefings with those groups.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, very good. All right, I got a comment from Michael Gernick, and I put it in. If you want to comment on the comment, I think he is saying exactly what you're saying. He says FEMA has focused more on disaster recovery monies rather than preparedness ahead of time. This is all about giving more to the private sector, and it reeks of politics. We cannot continue to have a constant do-over when disasters occur.
I agree.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, at the point, it seems, at the point where, you're pointing out these $50 billion, and I think Congress is going through this right now, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, they just had to do a big supplemental for the National Flood Insurance, the Sandy Disaster Recovery Assistance, and folks are starting to ask about the price tag, are they not?
They are, and I think this is the first time that I recall where there was actually some hesitancy on voting on the disaster relief bill.
Right.
And I think, again, it's because of the constraints, the economic constraints that we're all working under. And, you know, why are we allowing communities to make decisions where they're not taking responsibility for their actions, where they allow people to develop on barrier islands or to redevelop on barrier islands or to develop along known floodplains. And then when the flood comes, the community says, oh, well, the federal government will come bail us out. So I think we need to shift our thinking. We need to develop in a way that brings the economic engines to communities, but does it in a way where the assets are protected and where the community is resilient when that inevitable flood hits.
And, of course, it's coming out of all of our pockets.
Absolutely.
All right. We've pretty much reached the end. I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up at this time. Oh, I forgot to preload the stand by with me, folks. I need to load our form. I forgot to do it. Okay, let me get here.
I can take one of the questions talks about marketing.
Oh, okay. In fact, you may have gotten a direct question I didn't see. Please go ahead, Susan.
One of the thoughts that I have.
Please state what the question was because we're not.
The question says, our culture is based around, it's from Mike Gregory. Our culture is based around marketing. You mentioned that we've not done a good job at getting the resilience and mitigation messages out. Is it time for us to use the marketing professionals?
Uh-huh.
And I would like to see, you know, a mass marketing Super Bowl type campaign on resilience. I'm not sure who would fund it, but gosh, wouldn't that be great?
Absolutely. Okay. So we will go ahead and wrap it up. And then on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much, Susan, for joining us and all your efforts towards evidence-based disaster policies. We wish you continued success in the future.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
And thanks to all our participants today for all the good questions and comments. Really, really stimulating. Appreciate that. But before you all run off, please do take a moment to complete our little feedback form and or any additional comments you may have. Now, our next program is scheduled for February 13th, and please watch for our announcement and make plans to join us then. Again, if you're not subscribed to our mailing list, you can go to our homepage, and up near the top left, there is a place where you can get it, where you can subscribe, pardon me. And again, I will have the recordings and the slides posted late this afternoon. You can go to our homepage at eInform.org, and you'll see the announcement has changed, and there will be links to the materials. So again, thanks to everyone for participating today. Have a great afternoon. Bye now.